Mesdames, Messieurs, chers collègues, membres de la famille et amis de feu John E. C. Brierley, Monsieur le professeur George Furman, permettez-moi de vous offrir à tous la plus chaleureuse des bienvenues à la conférence commémorative John E. C. Brierley. My name is Daniel Jutras. I'm the Dean of the Faculty of Law at this great university, and it is a distinct pleasure for me to say a few words of welcome on this occasion. We're experimenting with new microphones today. That's better. There we go. This lecture, as you know, this lecture series, in effect, this is one in the series, honors the life, leadership, and legacy of John E. C. Brierley, scholar, professor, and dean of this faculty whose towering intellect shone at McGill for over 35 years. This is quite annoying. I think this should be better. Little. Yes? Still some reverberation. Eh? Well, let me keep going and speak less loudly. So, to repeat, because maybe we've lost track, this lecture series honors the life, leadership, and legacy of John Brierley, as a scholar, my colleague, a professor, and dean of this faculty, whose towering intellect shone at McGill for over 35 years. Depuis 2004, cette conférence commémorative nous a permis d'entendre les plus grands spécialistes du droit de l'arbitrage, Yves Fortier, Andreas Lowenfeld, Jan Paulsen, Emmanuel Gaillard, et Alain Priginaire, qui se joint à nous encore une fois ce soir, mais cette fois-ci à titre de président de la section de droit international de l'Association du barreau canadien pour le Québec. La conférence de ce soir sera livrée par le professeur George Berman, un des acteurs les plus respectés de la scène de l'arbitrage international, dont la présence parmi nous souligne encore une fois l'héritage de John Brierley. Je crois qu'on peut dire sans crainte de se tromper que McGill est aujourd'hui devenu l'un des hauts lieux de la réflexion sur l'arbitrage commercial international. John Brierley can be credited with taking the first steps in bringing McGill to this prominent position in the field of arbitration, with his visionary doctoral thesis on the subject in 1965, and his inspired and critical exploration of private justice as a scholar and teacher. It may be a sign that one is getting old when one can remember the presence of those giants after whom events and buildings are named. Well, I don't remember Chancellor Day, a little too young for that. I have fondest memories of Paul-André Crépeau and John Brierley, who embodied everything that McGill was for half a century and whose names now bring honor to a memorial lecture and a research center, respectively. I hope some of you live long enough to attend the Fabien Gélinas Memorial Lecture or to enter the Demitral Hall or to meet the recipient of the Frédéric Bachand or Geneviève Saumier Doctoral Fellowship. We are indeed blessed with a unique constellation of scholars in this field, in the faculty, whose contribution will continue to resonate in the future. Les étudiants et étudiantes profitent ici des enseignements d'un remarquable groupe de professeurs qui animent des travaux riches et innovateurs sur l'arbitrage et le commerce international. Je pense à ceux que je viens de nommer, bien entendu, mais aussi à Andrew Bjorklund, qui s'est joint à nous cette année comme professeur invité, ainsi qu'à tous nos partenaires de l'arbitrage et de la justice privée, étudiants au cycle supérieur, avocats et avocates au sein des cabinets d'affaires de Montréal, et aussi collègues des autres facultés de droit du Québec, qui se rassemblent ici pour faire avancer la réflexion sur les champs émergents de création du droit transnational et d'adjudication des conflits hors de l'espace étatique. Je m'en voudrais de ne pas souligner l'apport financier de nos partenaires et amis. C'est ainsi que la conférence Brierley a bénéficié chaque année de la générosité et de la loyauté du cabinet Woods, représenté ce soir par Maître Sylvain Beauclair, qui commandite la réception qui se tiendra à l'issue de nos travaux de ce soir. J'ai gardé pour la fin des remerciements tout particuliers à Maître Yves Fortier, dont le généreux don à la Faculté de droit de l'Université McGill rend possible la tenue de cette conférence commémorative John Brierley et en assure la pérennité. La faculté est l'heureuse bénéficiaire du soutien indéfectible de Maître Fortier ainsi que, plus largement, du cabinet Norton Rose, qui a été son point d'attache pendant plusieurs décennies. Tous les deux contribuent de manière tangible à l'avancement du droit de l'arbitrage et du commerce international. Maître Fortier est en route vers La Haye pour un arbitrage important et m'a demandé de vous transmettre ses meilleurs vœux. Thank you all for your presence tonight, and once again, a special word of thanks to our friend Jane, John Barley's widow, and to his son Timothy, whom I saw earlier. Both of whom have graced us with their presence, I think, on every occasion. It's a great pleasure to have you here with us, faithful participants in this unique event. Thank you again, Jane, for being here. Je cède maintenant la parole à mon collègue, professeur Fabien Gélinda, qui nous présentera notre conférencier et invité d'honneur. Merci.
Merci, Daniel. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Je voudrais d'abord souhaiter la bienvenue à toutes et à tous à cet événement très important de la vie intellectuelle de notre faculté et saluer la présence de plusieurs participants à la conférence Le droit hors d'État, The Stateless Law, The Future of the Discipline, qui débute ses travaux ici même demain matin. Merci aux organisateurs et particulièrement à mon collègue Lionel Smith d'avoir permis l'association des deux événements. Alors, l'un des points fondamentaux de cette association est nul autre que notre conférencier de ce soir. Notre conférencier de ce soir est une encyclopédie du savoir juridique cosmopolite, une machine à idées, un pont à la fois de l'université et de la société globale des arbitres, un pont, donc, entre la raison théorique et la raison pratique. It would be very hard indeed to think of anyone who would be better placed than our guest tonight to help us begin to make sense of one of the most difficult issues facing international arbitration today. George Berman went to Yale College, where he obtained his BA with the highest honors. This earned him a Marshall Scholarship, which allowed him to study in England before enrolling in law at Yale. At Yale, he was an editor of the Yale Law Journal. He also studied at Columbia Law School, where he obtained an LLM and ultimately joined the faculty. Columbia has been his home since then. He is now Jean Monnet Professor of EU Law there, as well as Walter Gellhorn Professor of Law, and he holds a doctorate honoris causa from Université de Fribourg in Switzerland. Not content to hold several chairs, Professor Berman also wears many hats. He is president of the International Academy of Comparative Law, ou pour les intimes, l'Académie internationale de droit comparé. He is honorary president of the American Society of Comparative Law. He is co-director of the Center for International Commercial and Investment Arbitration at Columbia. He's a director of the American Arbitration Association. He's a member of the International Arbitration Club of New York, and he's a member of the Academic Council of the Institute for Transnational Arbitration. Professor Berman is a much sought after and highly engaging teacher. He could easily teach most law courses off the cuff and enchant the students. And he could do this in several countries. And indeed, he has done this in several countries. He has or has had affiliations as visiting professor or scholar at Sciences Po in Paris, at the Collège d'Europe in Bruges, at Tulane Law School in New Orleans, at the New York University School of Law, the Max Planck Institute for Foreign Public Law and International Law, and Princeton University's Center for International Studies. He was also a Tocqueville Fulbright Distinguished Professor at Université de Paris, and he was in residence at some point in the past at the Legal Services of the European Commission in Brussels, as well as at the French Conseil d'État in Paris. The diversity of his experience of law and legal institutions at the highest level is simply outstanding. Professor Berman is also a prolific author of scholarly works. I have a list of selected publications by him, which runs into a number of pages that my printer could not handle. And so let me just say that his universally respected works span many disciplines and many jurisdictions. Together with Professor Emmanuel Gaillard, he's currently working on the Uncitral Guide to the New York Convention. He is also a modern-day codifier, acting as chief reporter of the American Law Institute for the restatement of the U.S. law of international commercial arbitration. Professor Berman's approach has always been informed by practice, bringing insights to his work that many other scholars simply do not have. He's often called upon to testify before legislative committees and courts of law in many jurisdictions. He has advised and represented states and parastatal entities in large international cases. He regularly acts as arbitrator in international commercial cases, and he's rated one of the top international arbitration lawyers. His passion for arbitration is that of a scholar with an eye on practice and that of a practitioner with an eye on theory. In both practice and theory, his passion never gets in the way of clear thinking. This will come in handy because he has chosen what many, indeed most of us, would consider an impossible subject. I feel it would be a loss to all of us if I were to keep you waiting any longer. It is my distinct pleasure to introduce Professor George Berman.
Well, that's a very humbling introduction, and I thank you. I thank you from way down, and I also thank the dean and everybody who's come today, not especially to hear me, but to honor John Brierley. And as I said to Jane Brierley when I came in, I knew John quite well. I was a little bit younger, but we were both beginning, I think, comparatists in the University of Paris and elsewhere. And I always considered him the outstanding North American comparatist. He was the North American René David. And I therefore am deeply honored to have the opportunity to give a lecture in his name. The topic that I've chosen is not a particularly original one. In fact, it's probably as old as arbitration itself. The relationship between courts and arbitral tribunals, it's been a perennial preoccupation of international arbitration law, and for good reasons. And I think all legal systems struggle with it. Hopefully, not quite as fitfully as the American legal system is today. And I will concentrate my remarks on the experience of the United States, but I suspect that in some degree it reflects some of the challenges being faced in Canada and elsewhere. The problem arises from a fundamental dilemma with which we're all familiar. Legal systems in arbitration, legal systems that fail adequately to police the well-foundedness of assertions of arbitral authority, run the very real risk of jeopardizing arbitration's very legitimacy. We know that in general, persons are required to arbitrate a dispute only if and to the extent that they consented to do so, and courts are expected to make some sort of inquiry into the existence, the validity, the bien fondé, that will be my only French word, of that consent if it is in fact contested. On the other hand, and equally important, I want to emphasize, legal systems that tolerate excessive intervention by courts into matters of arbitral jurisdiction present the very real risk of impeding, if not derailing, arbitration altogether and placing in jeopardy arbitration's chief advantages, among them speed, efficiency, and economy. That an issue as important as this and that it's been around as long as this, evidently does not mean it necessarily has become settled, because indeed it hasn't. Only last week, a most respected member of the American judiciary, a former colleague of mine, Gerard Lynch from the Second Circuit, was asked what the appreciation of the American judiciary was for international commercial arbitration. And he said, and I quote, that the view from the bench is mostly cloudy with intermittent bursts of sunlight. Afterwards, he told me, the judiciary is ignorant. He is not, however, ignorant about international commercial arbitration. But the fact is that the subject I'm speaking about today is one that has continued to plague American courts, and it hasn't gotten any better. And while I expect from the little research I've been able to do into Canadian law, while I suspect that you're not in this bad shape, I may be disabused of that, perhaps, I suspect there are some unsettled problems of the sort that I mean to address today. Now, arbitration practice, we know, and arbitration theory tells us that there are no fewer than three moments in the life cycle of an arbitration when courts may and perhaps must question the adequacy of arbitral jurisdiction, at least if they're asked to do so. The most common, and the one that I've been focusing on recently, is before any arbitral proceeding has even begun. A party has gone to court with a claim that is arguably subject to arbitration, and the defendant seeks dismissal of the action for want of jurisdiction due precisely to the arbitration clause, whose infirmities may then come in for scrutiny. Shall the court refer the parties to arbitration? Shall it not? Second, an arbitration has been conducted, of course, eventually. An award has been rendered, and it is subject to challenge in a court that is competent to entertain a challenge to the award. And almost every challenge that may be brought at that moment is a challenge that might have been brought at the very outset. And an award that is either not challenged or challenged but survives is, of course, has often enough need to be enforced by a court of a third jurisdiction. And that court, too, is going to be asked to take a look at the jurisdictional adequacy of the tribunal that rendered the award. Now, legal systems vary very considerably as to how they fashion the proper role of courts at these moments. And I want to suggest that in the United States, at least, the subject has been given woefully inadequate attention by our courts and to a certain extent by our scholarly community. And the very fact that the subject matter of today is entitled The Arbitrability Trap tells you that there's something about the notion of arbitrability that is at the heart of the problem. And indeed, I think it is. The problem of arbitrability, and sometimes it is, of course, non-arbitrability, the problem of arbitrability has, for today's purposes at least, four aspects that I'd like to discuss with you. First, and most fundamentally, used in the fashion in which it is used in the United States, to which I'll return shortly, the term arbitrability masks a rather incredible range of different issues. And unless we draw some distinctions among the conditions upon which the enforceability of an arbitration agreement depends, we will end up treating every imaginable challenge to the enforcement of an arbitration agreement in the same fashion. And I question whether that's appropriate. Do they all have the same character? Do they all have the same importance? Do they all call upon the same capabilities and respective and relative capabilities of courts and arbitrators? And should they be looked at differently depending upon the moment in the life cycle of the arbitration when the question is raised? Now, the second of my aspects is closely related. The reason why the term arbitrability was invented in the first place, at least in the American lexicon, was in order to begin to understand what the respective roles of courts and arbitrators are and should be in the matter of arbitral jurisdiction. And it seems to me the fact that we conceive of arbitrability, or we risk conceiving of arbitrability in so indiscriminate a fashion as we do, at least in my country, disables us from making that very determination for which the notion of arbitrability was coined, in my judgment. Third, I think it has been assumed, or at least not questioned very much, that the inquiry is pretty much the same whenever a court is asked to make it, whether it's asked to make it at the gateway, whether it's asked to make it in a vacatur action, whether it's asked to make it of a foreign award brought for recognition and enforcement. And then, finally, and most topically today, fourth but most recently, is the question of whether we should regard any or all some of those grounds as ones grounds for impeaching the validity of an arbitration agreement as ones that we think are so serious that the parties maybe should not even be able to confer through express language of their own primary authority upon the arbitrators. So I have four matters to discuss with you today, and I hope I stay within the remotely at least within the time you allot me. You didn't, however, tell me how much time you allotted me. No, you didn't. Okay, first, just what does this all-encompassing term of arbitrability encompass? What might it mean? Second, and you saw this coming, should the allocation of primary authority to answer the various questions that arbitrability encompasses, should they be allocated differently? Should that authority be allocated differently between courts and tribunals depending upon the challenge at hand? What difference should it make or might it make as to whether the challenge is brought at the outset of the life cycle or toward the end of the life cycle of the arbitration? And as I said a moment ago, may the parties effectively delegate the resolution of challenges that ordinarily should be heard by a court independently and de novo to the arbitral tribunal as an exercise in party autonomy. May they so determine. Now, I think we have an arbitrability trap, at least in the United States, because we risk addressing all of these issues poorly because of our indiscriminate notion of arbitrability. Now, I'm going to speak primarily to the dismay of my good friend, Andrea Bjorklund, of commercial arbitration and not investor-state arbitration. However, beware. Beware, the problems I'm about to address, while they haven't yet surfaced in investor-state arbitration, could well do so, and I hope I recall in the course of this lecture the moment at which it is to give the exact event that I expect to occur in the near to medium term in investment arbitration, which will raise arbitrability questions. And I hope I do remember to do that. Now, I'm not going to explore in full detail. I'm going to give you an inventory, in effect, of what arbitrability might mean. But before I begin, I should say many cultures would wonder why I would even construct an address on this subject, because arbitrability has a well-understood meaning in most of the world. In most of the world, probably in Canada as well, A dispute is arbitrable if it is legally capable of being arbitrated. That is to say, if the legislature, it will typically be the legislature, has determined that a dispute or a claim is of a sort that is not legally amenable to arbitration, which means has been reserved to the judiciary. That is not as easy to describe and to identify. It's a very interesting question. And I must add that though it's not the subject of my talk, it is extremely interesting to observe the choice of law rules that govern the arbitrability question. Those of you who know the model law, and you all do, know the Unsutral model law, will know that a court consults its own, we're told, law on arbitrability, whether it is the court ordering arbitration, whether it is the court entertaining an annulment action, or whether it is the court entertaining an enforcement action, which would be very simple if it were always the same court. But it is in the nature of international arbitration that it will be the court of country A that compels arbitration, the court of country B that has the authority to vacate the award, and the courts of country C that may or may not enforce the award. And if each of them does what the model law says, which is to apply its own law on arbitrability to the question of arbitrability, our award must survive three different arbitrability tests. But that's not my subject. I just want to say that even if we took a properly restricted view of arbitrability, we would have things to talk about. But the point is, I think, that we don't have the luxury any longer in the United States to conceive of arbitrability in such a refined and well-defined fashion as you do in Canada, and that is because our judiciary, even at the highest levels, has chosen to caption a wide and highly heterogeneous group of issues as all issues of arbitrability. That is the source of our problem, and it has showing no signs of abating. Let me give you my inventory that you've been waiting for, I hope. An arbitrability question may include whether there ever was an agreement to arbitrate. That is to say, did an agreement to arbitrate ever eventuate? That could be as mundane as was an offer accepted, but anything else that you regard as constitutive of an agreement. If an agreement was entered into, was it entered into in a fashion that causes a individual person, juridical or natural person, to be a signatory or deemed to be a signatory, who, though not having signed an arbitration agreement, is a party to it, or deemed to be a party to it. I call the first question for shorthand, was there ever an agreement, the whether question, and the second question, the who question. Now, unfortunately, I do not have enough personal pronouns in my vocabulary to attach one to every one of the arbitrability species that I'm about to speak to. But those two do have personal pronouns that we can use. If we have an arbitration agreement, and it does in fact bind or may be invoked by whoever it is who is in question, we commonly are asked, is it valid? Is it valid in any one of a number of respects? And usually those respects are all under the tent of the law of contract. Fraud, misrepresentation, coercion, unconscionability, whatever it may be. In the United States, we have those same three questions that sometimes are addressed not to the arbitration agreement, but to the contract in which the arbitration agreement is found. And we have the separability doctrine that is meant to help us there. But if you're counting with me, and you count each of these twice, because they can be leveled at the arbitration clause or at the contract, we have six conceptions of arbitrability. But that's only the beginning. Does the dispute at hand fall within the scope of the agreement to arbitrate? That's an age-old issue. What does the scope entail? What disputes come within it? Is the dispute arbitrable in the proper sense of the term? Did whoever has the authority to do so determine that the dispute at hand is one that may legally be arbitrated? Is the dispute, though fully arbitrable by nature, is it one that has been reserved for determination by some other body? Now, that's relatively rare, that we have reserved arbitrable claims, arbitrable in the sense that they are legally capable of being arbitrated, reserve them for entities other than arbitral tribunals, but actually, American law, under some circumstances, reserves them to bankruptcy courts and bankruptcy tribunals under certain circumstances. So is an otherwise arbitrable dispute non-arbitrable because it must be heard, if at all, by a bankruptcy court or tribunal? Did the party invoking arbitration satisfy all the conditions precedent to arbitration? Mediation comes to mind, right? Conciliation, exhaustion of one or another remedy. Let's call that conditions precedent. Our courts attach the term arbitrability to the question of whether the conditions precedent to arbitration have been satisfied. Has the statute of limitations on the underlying claim run? That, too, has been described as an arbitrability question in the United States. Something as, if you will, mundane as the statute of limitations. Did a party who is a party to an existing arbitration agreement that contemplates an arbitrable dispute, in other words, survives every one of my hurdles, nevertheless do or say something that constitutes a waiver of the right to arbitrate? Do we want to call that an arbitrability question? Like our courts seem to want to do so. Is the dispute itself, that is the subject of the prospective arbitration, or the award that has been rendered, is it one that actually has already been resolved by a court or an arbitral tribunal in the past? Is it precluded from relitigation? If so, it's not arbitrable any longer. Is the claim one, even, that is amenable to class arbitration? Because as a practical matter, some claims, if not amenable to class arbitration, won't be arbitrated. Now, all of these are threshold questions that American courts are calling arbitrability, in extreme contrast from the well-disciplined use you have in Canada of the term arbitrability. I don't even think I've exhausted the menu. I'm sure there are others, and there will continue to be more. I do not mean to denigrate any of these by wanting to withhold the term arbitrability from them. They are all serious issues in their own way. They're all legitimate issues to be raised, asked, and answered. But do they all deserve the same treatment? And that brings me to my second aspect, which is one in which we focus on who should have the primary authority to determine arbitrability questions. Now, clearly, and you'll all agree with me, that there isn't a single question I have raised that an arbitral tribunal cannot answer if asked. The arbitral tribunal can determine every single one of the questions I put on the table. If competence means anything, it means all of that and possibly more. But our concern, of course, is that a court may be asked to answer those questions before an arbitral tribunal has had a chance to get its hands on it. before the tribunal has even been constituted. And then what do we do? And please don't regard that as an unlikely scenario for several reasons. First, if you look at the cases, you will, I think, agree with me that the arbitrability question, and I'm using the term indiscriminately now, in fact, from this point onward in this talk, I will use the term arbitrability in the way of which I disapprove. For convenience, but don't quote me. If you look at the cases raising arbitrability questions, far more often than not, they arise because a party's gone to court rather than arbitration. And the arbitration agreement becomes an affirmative defense. And therefore, immediately, the party seeking to remain in the court, it will occur to him or her or it to challenge the validity, or better yet, the enforceability of that arbitration agreement, so as to defeat the motion to dismiss. Now, by definition, this issue is coming before a court, before an arbitral tribunal has even been formed in most cases. Secondly, any party seriously seeking, for whatever reason, to avoid arbitration would rather have that question decided by anybody but an arbitrator. I do not have to explain that, do I? Arbitrators are not known for the alacrity with which they decline jurisdiction. Therefore, a party seriously seeking, for whatever good or bad reason it may be, to avoid arbitration would much rather have that question determined by a court than by an arbitrator. And finally, if for no other good reason, you really had better challenge the arbitration agreement at the earliest stage in which the question arises, or you risk waiving the challenge altogether. So I invite you to consider that it is indeed no longer the exception that the arbitrability of a dispute is determined by a court rather than by an arbitral tribunal, notwithstanding competence in all of its glory. Now, which of these arbitrability species are the ones that warrant independent, serious, independent judicial scrutiny, if sought? And we do not need all to agree on how we will allocate these, but we do need to recognize that there is wisdom in allocating them. Let me give you a sense of the range of how one might come to this question. Let us begin with arbitrability and its proper usage. Is a dispute one that the legislature of the state that created the cause of action, is it one that it contemplated could be arbitrated legally? I think almost everybody would agree, but there could be dissent within the room, that that is a question that if raised before a court prior to arbitration should be answered by the court. Our courts had no problem in the United States answering the question of whether antitrust claims were arbitrable in the Mitsubishi case prior to the arbitration. That is a legal question that a judge is at least as well qualified, arguably better qualified, to answer than an arbitrator. That's relatively easy. But was an agreement to arbitrate ever concluded in the first place? And who is bound by the agreement to arbitrate in the first place? And we may disagree over that, but I think if we think about it long and hard, we would say these are core questions, fundamental jurisdictional questions, that if seriously raised, should be seriously answered by a court and not left for the arbitral tribunal independently to decide. There may be others in this room who feel otherwise. The Supreme Court has suggested, actually, that it appreciates that, and that there is a difference between some arbitrabilities and other arbitrabilities in this regard. It has actually suggested that whether an arbitration agreement has been formed and whether you are a party to it is, in fact, a substantive arbitrability question that is properly answered by a court. Don't be confused by the term substantive. We're not talking about the merits of the case. We're talking about the substance of the arbitrability question. And that others of these are not to be determined by a court, even if it is asked to do so at the outset. And the court has put into that category an arbitrability species at the other extreme, which would be, for example, the statute of limitations. And in the Hauzon case, the Supreme Court clearly said, let the arbitrator decide whether the statute of limitations has run. Now, I'm not going to take you through all these species. That would be extremely tedious. But the challenge for us is to say some preconditions to the enforcement of an arbitration agreement are more weighty than others. Implicate consent more fundamentally than others, and therefore may warrant treatment differently. This is not an easy exercise. I do not mean to minimize it. And that can be proven by our looking at the very arbitrability species, which consists of asking, is the dispute within the scope of the arbitration agreement? That surely has a consent dimension to it. You don't agree to arbitrate in the abstract. You agree to arbitrate a universe of claims. If you didn't agree to arbitrate a given claim, there is a consent problem. On the other hand, determining the scope of the arbitration agreements is a core contract interpretation question. And that is what our arbitrators are there for. And so we find, in fact, and here's, I think, an area where the courts have really gotten it right, that when it comes to deciding whether a dispute is within the scope of the arbitration clause, a somewhat intermediate position should be taken. The court will look at the issue and maybe indulge in a presumption that the arbitration clause covers the dispute, or settle for a prima facie showing that the arbitration clause covers the dispute. But I think it's fair to say that it is really incumbent on the courts, and our courts have not quite done it right, I think, to determine whether and to what extent the court's intervention on these issues is warranted and to what extent it depends on what the issue is. I'm convinced of that. Now, if I'm correct then in that, we do ourselves a great disservice in calling all of these things arbitrability and treating them generically. I think the court has tried to avoid that pitfall, but our lower courts have not succeeded in following that example. And it is ironic and perhaps, well, regrettable that the term upon which we rely for deciding who appropriately has the primary authority is defined in such a way as to frustrate our ability to make that very determination. The Supreme Court said in the Hauzon case, you know what we should do? We should ask ourselves what the parties would have wanted about these matters. Well, I defy you to tell me whether the parties had any views on the subject of who has primary authority to decide whether the statute of limitations has elapsed. They may not even know what the statute of limitations means, much less worry about who has primary authority over those issues. So I don't take that very seriously. But I do think we have other considerations that we should take seriously. And it will not surprise you to know that I think we should be focusing on the relative capabilities of the courts and the arbitral tribunals and the relative extent to which the legitimacy of arbitration and the legitimacy of the resulting award is in the balance. And I don't want you to misread me, it's easy to do so, as always favoring judicial intervention, because I think it's just as important that the issues that don't warrant independent judicial determination not get it, as it is important that those that do warrant early and independent judicial intervention get it. In other words, it is, in my view at least, very seriously a two-way street. And it is not simply legitimacy of arbitration. Overall, it is the appropriate balance between legitimacy and efficacy. And we will make a great contribution to that if we take a closer and harder look at what arbitrability means. Now, I turn to my third aspect of the problem. And here I will sound less dogmatic, because I'm not sure what I think about this yet, but I'm sure it should be thought about. And that is, what difference the timing makes. It's one thing already for us to actually draw up the inventory of arbitrability issues, allocate them for better or for worse, even put the scope question on the borderline between the one category and the other, and now I'm giving you a really complicated geometry and asking you whether that complex thing varies according to whether the judicial intervention is before the arbitration or after the arbitration, pre-award or post-award. I don't think, and I genuinely do not think, courts in any jurisdiction, except possibly France, which has a very firm, and I would say dogmatic view on the question, seriously thought about exactly how the judicial intervention on these questions should vary. But it certainly could or should vary. Let me give you two easy examples before we get to the hard ones. Surely, if a party, and this was discussed in this very room last November, I think it was last November, discussed in this room, this very topic, should a party that proceeded to arbitration without raising the objection at hand be able to raise it for the first time when an unfavorable award comes down? And I think we said no. So the court may not entertain the very same question that it would have entertained if raised at an appropriate time, because it was not raised at the appropriate time. That's easy. That's child's play. That's waiver 101, right? Second, to what extent is the court that is asked to deny recognition to an award, should it consider itself bound by the finding of the court that compelled arbitration that the dispute fell within the scope of the arbitration clause, or that X, Y, or Z was a party to the arbitration agreement? Now, those are questions that can come up at every moment. And there is a very serious issue, which the restatement is knee-deep in, as some of you in the room know, as to the extent to which there should be preclusion. Preclusion based upon the prior adjudication of the common issue, even if by a different court or a court of a different jurisdiction. But even if we put the easy cases aside, waiver and preclusion, there still is also this question about whether the look taken later should be more deep and profound and rigorous than the look taken earlier, or vice versa. It's very interesting to explore this question. Here we know what the French view is. At the front end, very little inquiry. A dispute is sent to arbitration unless the arbitration agreement is manifestly void or manifestly inapplicable. But after the award has been rendered, at least purportedly, the review of all these matters is independent and de novo. We might question that in terms of efficiency. We might question that. But at least the question has been entertained by the French authorities. Judge Lynch, whom I referred to earlier, for whom I had great admiration, notwithstanding his having been a Columbia Law professor, has in a leading decision, the Telenor decision, said effectively, I'm prepared to let an issue go to a dispute, go to arbitration, by taking a deferential or lighthearted view of the matter, just to give the arbitrators the first chance, the first crack at it, so I can be educated by what they found. And that maybe will resolve the dispute, and maybe I'll never have to answer the question because the parties will have settled. But at the end of the day, before I enforce that award, if there is a serious issue, I'm going to look at it independently and de novo. Now that's contested, and I'm not going to solve that one here today. But there you have a view that reaffirms the French view, I think, that actually the front end look should be lighthearted, relatively. I'm not sure it should be, but that's the view. But at the back end, it's rigorous. It's just a lot, perhaps, to ask our courts not only to parse arbitrability among its various species, but also parse it over time, over the life cycle of an arbitration. But I think we should be doing that. Now, what about after the award has come down? What about that? What should the role actually be? We have a major decision that many of you know called the first options decision in the United States, which said effectively the who question and the whether question. Whether an agreement was formed and who is bound by that agreement or may invoke it is a question that is presumptively subject to de novo review even after the award has been rendered and even if the arbitral tribunal in its exercise of competence has made a determination on that matter. It won't surprise you that I think that's right. This is the who question, this is the whether question. I think that's very important. And so we can, I think, establish that there are some of the arbitrability questions that get or ought to get as rigorous an inquiry at the rear end as at the front end. And I think you would agree with me, perhaps, that some of the other arbitrability issues should not get de novo review of what the arbitrators found. Do we really want a court taking an independent view of whether the statute of limitations had passed? Well, perhaps you do, but I don't think it is warranted. But I think these are the questions that need to be asked and answered. And we're very far from having done that. Very far from having done that. The matter I've just described is really shockingly still open. Now, I come mercifully to my last aspect of the problem, which is the one that's topical, the one that's in the arbitration press these days. But it's still related to arbitrability, or I wouldn't be mentioning it. And it's the question of whether, in an exercise of party autonomy, the party should be able to convert an arbitrability issue that warrants de novo review by a court into one that gets deferential review by a court, because that's what the parties agreed upon. So what is the delegability of the arbitrability? That's terrible, sounds terrible, doesn't it? What is the delegability of the arbitrability question? But that's really what it really comes down to. And once again, I already see, as that question is emerging, the delegability of the arbitrability question, a failure to distinguish among our arbitrability issues. And I can be very precise here. In the first options case, as many of you know, the courts didn't simply say that review of whether there was an arbitration agreement or who was a party to it is presumptively for de novo judicial review after the award has come down, but it said that is a rebuttable presumption. And it may be rebutted by clear and unmistakable evidence that the parties intended for that question or those questions not to be reviewed independently. And that's what it said. And it found in that case, in first options, that the parties had not so signified. They had not signified that intention, and the court actually took an independent view of the matter and found, indeed, that the parties against whom the award had been rendered were not parties to the arbitration agreement in the exercise of de novo review. But now we're living in the world today, 2012, of trying to figure out what is clear and unmistakable evidence by the parties that they intended that an issue, and for the sake of argument, agree with me, please, that there are some issues that warrant de novo review at the end of the day. What will it take to establish clear and unmistakable evidence that the parties didn't care to get de novo review, even of a core, fundamental, consent-related, legitimacy-related issue? Well, I would like to spend the time, but I don't have it now, to tell you that I think we should not even ever entertain the idea that the parties can clearly and unmistakably agree to deferential review on the basis of contract language found in a contract that they claim is a forgery. I have a problem with that. If I'm not a party to the contract, and I seriously maintain it, why do I have to submit that question to a tribunal that owes its existence entirely to that contract? But we must live with that. Clear and unmistakable evidence of an intention, either in the contract or surrounding the contract, that the parties bargained for deferential review to the arbitrators, even on the most fundamental question. Well, today, we know that courts in the United States are routinely finding clear and unmistakable evidence of an intention to delegate the determination of the most core arbitrability questions, the most core jurisdictional questions, on the basis of a competence-competence clause in the rules of the American Arbitration Association. So court after court today is saying, you signed an arbitration agreement that incorporated the rules of the American Arbitration Association, and the rules of the American Arbitration Association contain a competence-competence clause. Therefore, you have clearly and unmistakably delegated to the arbitrators the right to primary decision-making authority over whether there ever was an agreement in the first place, or over whether you are, as a non-signatory, to be deemed a party to that arbitration agreement. Now, I will admit that the AAA rules were, in fact, amended after first options precisely to make that possible. I have the language here, I hope I do. The language is to the effect that competence-competence includes the competence to determine the validity and existence of the arbitration agreement. So make no mistake about it. The American Arbitration Association seized the opportunity to revise the rules in order to beef up the competence-competence clause so that it didn't just cover the question of what dispute the arbitration agreement covers, but whether there was one, but whether there was one, or whether it binds the party sought to be bound. Now, I have no doubt that the American Arbitration Association had a clear and unmistakable intention to reach that result. But I'm not sure whether the American Arbitration Association's intention is what we're after. It's a really fundamental question. That is what they wanted. But is that what parties who signed arbitration agreements intended? And I think without much thought, our courts are showing a strong tendency to say The rules you adopted, incorporated by reference in your arbitration agreement, happen to have a competence-competence clause, and that is clear and unmistakable evidence that you intended to forfeit your otherwise right to an independent de novo judicial review over a core jurisdictional and legitimacy question. If we go that road, then what about the world in which we don't just incorporate by reference arbitral rules that contain competence-competence clauses, but what if the model law is adopted around the whole world? Now, the model law has a competence-competence clause in it. So are we now in the world that these core issues, the who, the whether, that these issues are delegated to the arbitral tribunal because we are arbitrating in a jurisdiction whose lex arbitri contains a competence-competence clause? Now, I do believe, but I could be wrong, that if we add together all those cases in which the award was rendered in a jurisdiction that has competence-competence in its lex arbitri, together with all those awards that result from arbitration agreements that contained references, incorporation by reference to rules containing a competence-competence clause, it will no longer seriously be the case that courts exercise de novo review over core jurisdictional questions because the clear and unmistakable intention of the party's exception has become the rule. The clear and unmistakable intention of the party's exception is no longer an exception. Now, I don't think our courts are even appreciating this. Maybe they would appreciate it and want to do this anyway. It is certainly imaginable that the pro-arbitration judiciary would actually say, yeah, I'll go for that. But I have serious doubts as to whether the courts even appreciate the magnitude, unless you think I'm exaggerating it, which is very likely, the magnitude of what they actually have done. Now, I come to the conclusion to all of this. The questions about these fundamental predicates, let's call them that, predicates of arbitration, these questions have been around for a long time, and so has the question of who properly is the center of gravity of determination of these questions. And I will agree, as is often said, that if the United States were to adopt the Arbitration Fairness Act, which would render arbitration clauses in consumer contracts and employment contracts unenforceable if they're pre-dispute agreements, that would massively mitigate the problem because most of our cases in which we feel deeply disturbed by some of the things I'm talking about are ones in which it was a consumer or an employee. But I'm not prepared to say either of the following two things. I'm not prepared to say we'll ever see the Arbitration Fairness Act, because I don't see anybody getting reelected to the Senate or the House of Representatives this November because they support the Arbitration Fairness Act. But secondly, because I don't believe that just because an arbitration agreement arises in a B2B context, I don't believe that just because an arbitration agreement arises in a B2B context that we don't have to worry about whether there actually was consent to arbitrate. I ask you to consider that even in the B2B context, we can seriously ask whether an agreement was formed. Just because they're two businesses doesn't mean they actually agreed, necessarily. Or whether a non-signatory corporate affiliate, or as in the first options case, Mr. and Mrs. Kaplan, whether they are the alter egos of the entity that did sign the arbitration agreement. Now, they are arguably consumers, but I'm not sure. that they were certainly merchants of a sort. I am not content to say everything I've described today will vanish as a concern with the passage, if it ever does occur, of the Arbitration Fairness Act. Now, I come full circle as I end. This is really important, it seems to me, because two of the most daunting criticisms of arbitration today are implicated in the discussion we've just had. One of them more obviously than the other. And I come back to my claim that it's a two-way street. It's just as bad to have de novo judicial review of things that don't deserve it as to not have de novo judicial review of things that do deserve it. And that is why the two most serious challenges facing arbitration in my world, anyway, are implicated by the debate that I've sought to generate here today. And those two are the two with which I began. There is a powerful critique that arbitration, in some circumstances, lacks legitimacy. Admittedly, usually it's a consumer who elicits that sympathy. But I insist it's not only the consumer. We need to be attentive to the legitimacy of arbitration, and legitimacy means consent to arbitrate. And I think in our enthusiasm for arbitration, we shouldn't forget that its foundation is consent. But equally, and on the other hand, we risk sacrificing the efficacy and efficiency values of arbitration if, conversely, we treat relatively negligible, pardon the expression, relatively negligible arbitrability questions as if they were that important that we should not show deference to the arbitrators. And the efficacy of arbitration, the utility of arbitration, is that not the other main challenge to arbitration today, at least among users of arbitration? I hear that it is. So, while this takes me into the weeds of the case law, and I'm sure maybe you'd rather not go there, into these weeds. We're in these weeds, but we're surrounded by, I think, among the most fundamental values that arbitration engenders. Is it sound? Is it fair? Is it legitimate? And is it fulfilling its promise of efficiency and utility? And so, for me, this enterprise, but maybe it may sound very taxing, and it is taxing. I've gotten even grayer as a result of thinking about this. I think it's worth it. And so I'm quite sure that there are many ways of doing better than our courts in the United States have done. But one thing I'm sure we can do better than is to use the term arbitrability as indiscriminately as we have been using it, and that's a good place to start. Thank you very much.
In terms of the question here.
Well, I want to engage Andrea in this debate, so here we go. Many people have said there are a lot of problems with investment arbitration. It is very complex. It is very conceptual, much more conceptual than commercial arbitration tends to be, notwithstanding my efforts to make it conceptual. It is not nearly as conceptual as investment arbitration. But one of the good things about it is that all the gateway questions, all the threshold questions, the arbitrators get to decide. They get to decide it, not courts. The courts don't tend, and it's, I think, the case thus far, the courts are not prejudging. They don't even not very often have the occasion to prejudge whether an arbitral tribunal in investment arbitration had jurisdiction. The core jurisdictional questions: was there an investment? What is the nationality of the investor? These are the core issues. Well, our arbitrators are getting to decide those issues. Am I prepared to say that our courts, outside ICSID, of course, outside of ICSID, will courts acquire the habit of re-examining those jurisdictional questions? I think we all assume they won't. Andrea must have views on this subject. I tend to assume they won't go there because they'll think that is just part of the heart of the inquiry, right? Is there an investment treaty claim? Well, what could be more central than whether there was an investor and an investment and the right nationalities were present? So there's, I think, reason to at least hope that the courts won't intervene on those questions. And we know they won't in ICSID, at least in principle. We know that. But there is this BG case. This case that has been decided by the DC Circuit, in which I think the very problem I described today has surfaced. And I don't want to drag you into the facts of the case, but it has gotten a lot of attention, most of it negative. I myself have authored a petition for certiorari to the Supreme Court on this case, but I'm not the only one. The American Arbitration Association has, the U.S. Council on International Business has, and several others. A court in the United States decided to review de novo whether the arbitral tribunal properly found that the conditions precedent to arbitration in Argentina, which in this case were a requirement to spend 18 months in the Argentine courts prior to arbitration, would have been futile. So the three arbitrators determined that while the treaty required an exhaustion of remedies of this sort, it would have been futile, and principles of international law under the Vienna Convention on Treaties would justify a tribunal in not enforcing the exhaustion of remedies requirement if exhaustion were futile. The court in the District of Columbia decided, and admittedly decided, de novo, that was not legitimate. So, satisfaction of conditions precedent, that was on my inventory. That was on my inventory, along with statute of limitations and waiver and res judicata, as ones that really don't warrant full-scale judicial intervention. Now, I think that's a sign already that investment treaty arbitration is not immune. Now, you have written on that case, haven't you? You have. And I think you've taken an equally good view. So I'm not teaching Andrea anything. But I do think that investment arbitration is not immune. There are structural features of investment treaty arbitration that will make it less frequent, less likely that these questions will arise. And ICSID is a big help because it keeps the courts out. But there is vulnerability.
But the basis of your main criticism is policy, like a bad sort of balancing of competing interests in a case in BG, or is it more fundamentally contractual in the sense that this is not what the parties wanted? The parties implicitly wanted the tribunal to have a final say on this, which would be sort of a contractual analysis to the allocation of power here. Or, from what I hear, you also have like a sort of a policy-based critique. Courts shouldn't get involved in that. It's not important enough. It's not core enough. Let the private judges deal with that. Or is it a combination of both?
I think it's a combination. And in fact, the amicus brief, the petition for certiorari addresses both aspects of the problem, and basically says we should be consulting international law for determining whether this is a legitimate end run. That's a pejorative term. I don't mean that, but let's you call it that. A legitimate end run around the exhaustion of remedies requirement. Mm-hmm. And secondly, whether this is in any event a question that we should regard as more an admissibility question than a jurisdictional question. I didn't use the term admissibility in my talk, and you noticed that. Mm-hmm. But the term admissibility has come into frequent use now to capture those threshold questions that aren't purely jurisdictional, so that the jurisdictional questions determine authority. Authority depends on them. Admissibility questions, what turns on that, what is affected by that, is the willingness to exercise authority. So I would say that the nature of this particular challenge is an admissibility nature, and I do not think it warrants de novo review. But that is part of the analysis.
Andrea Bjorklund, follow up or a new topic? Do you need a mic?
Follow up. I've been told to go to the podium. Apparently, that microphone is up. So, George?
Yeah, we have a softball.
No worries.
As we've already established, I generally agree with you. So, that would be fun for anybody, though. So, my question is based on what you said earlier about the importance of the who and the whether question in commercial arbitration as essential to the heart of the matter, and if I'm not misrepresenting you, as those questions that should not ever be taken away from the courts and their ability to exercise de novo review, why in an investment arbitration case, when you had questions about whether there's an investment and whether there's an investor, would those questions be taken away from a court who is asked to lend its authority in order to enforce an award?
That's a really good question. I have a couple of lame answers. One of them would be that I would actually invoke my relative capability question, the relative capacity consideration here, because I don't think it only depends on how important the question is. I hope I was clear. I think there's also relative capacities here. And I think our investment tribunals, whatever we may think of them and whatever critiques we may have of their composition, and we won't go there, right? They nevertheless can answer the question of what is an investment, it seems to me, most likely far better than a court can. So that's part of it. But then there's something else that I feel is lurking here. In commercial arbitration, the entire enterprise is based upon a contract. The geometry of investment treaty arbitration is simply different. We have a contract between states, right, Andrea? The contract is between states. It's a treaty.
One of the contracts.
There isn't always a contract.
There is not always a contract,
but there's always a treaty.
What?
So the
authority for what we're talking about.
Yes. So I don't feel that the authority of the investment arbitrators is as conditional on the consent of the disputants as in commercial arbitration, which derives its entire authority for being from a contract between the parties. Now, you may regard that as a distinction without a difference, but I do think those two considerations would cause me, probably, having not given it sufficient thought, to take the position that I could, without self-contradiction, insist on de novo review of the core who and whether questions in commercial arbitration without following that line in investment treaty arbitration.
There's a comeback.
Wait, no, just a quick follow-up, because I think what you're saying is that there are effectively two levels of state consent, right?
Yes.
Which is great. I mean, I think that's very interesting. What does it mean for counterclaim? Individual claimant who's only got one level of consent.
No, but that counterclaim is not based upon consent, is it?
Well, we don't necessarily... The investors, if the respondent state is going to submit a counterclaim against an investor, doesn't the investor have to have consented to the submission of the counterclaim against him?
Oh, that consent. Okay. Well, yes, but in the nature of a counterclaim. I mean, the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act suggests that foreign sovereigns consent, right, to being sued by virtue of their having brought a claim, certain claim. So a counterclaim doesn't give me a big problem, a consent problem. But good question.
Thank you, Andrea. Sir?
It seems to me that the trap to which you allude is really a form of paradox, because on the one hand, you have parties to arbitration who obviously have different expectations and different viewpoints about the process itself, and so when things, and this varies greatly among all the different states as well, and so when the process breaks down or becomes frozen, the courts intervene by jurists who are really not trained in the arbitration process, and so in effect they nullify the whole notion of what arbitration is all about and lose whatever benefit it has. And so you've obviously pointed out that it needs to be some kind of balance whereby each sphere does best what it does. However, in all due respect, sir, you haven't really indicated the mechanism that can somehow lead to that, other than the fact that it's a necessity to do so. I'd like to have some clue as to at least the beginning of a process that will lead in that direction.
Well, the process, if I understand you correctly, the process by which one arrives at the proper balance is a process that follows the line of reasoning that I tried to convey. That is to say, that examines the extent to which there is a legitimacy / consent stake in the matter, as compared to an efficiency, efficacy stake in that. Now, I think that is very illuminating distinction. And I think that leads me to results. What we can discuss, whether you're convinced or not, but I don't think I'm without a standard. My standard is a combination of an assessment of the consent versus efficiency stakes, on the one hand, and a relative capacity of courts and arbitrators to address the question on the other.
Okay, but I'd just like another word or two about your definition or explanation of consent. Exactly what consent are we talking about?
We're talking about the consent of a party to proceed to arbitration with its dispute, rather than go to a court. And it has a who, are you a party to that agreement? Was there an agreement? And does that agreement cover your dispute? Now, those are the substantive arbitrability questions. And I think they implicate consent. Let me ask you, do you think the statute of limitations implicates consent?
No.
No. So I get results. I think I get results from my colleagues.
However, okay, the only thing I
Thank
would
you.
Say
Thank
is
you, sir.
Last point.
Just
however, the only thing I would say is that people may have consent to start with, and then if they don't like the decision, they change their minds.
We'll take that one under reserve. Thank you, sir. Stephen Scott, last question. We have 2 minutes for both the question and the answer.
Okay.
Well, I don't know quite what label I would put on it, but I would put the label of unacceptable on it. okay? And whether I would call it a violation of due process or a taking of property, I don't quite know. But our legal system should not permit that. And I don't think we need to put this on the constitutional level. I mean, I'm happy to do so if you would like to do so. But it doesn't need to be. And we do avoid constitutional questions if we can do so. And it seems to me that we can resolve that question, as we're told we should, on non-constitutional grounds if we can do so. And I think I can resolve that question on non-constitutional grounds. I can resolve it on the grounds of the Federal Arbitration Act, which requires consent to arbitration. And I think I needn't elevate it to the constitutional level, although with you, I am moved. I am, as I suspect you are, I am moved by the constitutional dimension. But I would be loath to solve it on that basis. I don't think it's necessary. I think it's safer and sounder and more likely to command respect if we say, under those circumstances, the spirit, if not the letter, but probably also the letter of the law of arbitration has been offended.
Thank you very much. It's always a good sign when the moderator has to step in and stop the discussion or stop the formal part of the discussion. Thank you so much, George. Thank you, Stephen, for your question. Two last, quick last things. Thanks, first of all, to my colleague and dear friend, Fabien Gélinot, who has been the driving force behind this series of lectures since 2004, who has been helped by Kuzi Sharamba, who's still working. He's there, so if you come across him, thank him tonight for his wonderful work. And I would like to invite Maître Kuzi, we just talked about you. That was for you. Congratulations and thank you. I would like to invite Maître Sylvain Vauclair of Woods, our sponsor, to offer a few brief words and send us off to the informal part of the evening.
Thank you. I won't keep you long. I have a very enjoyable and easy job tonight. I will invite you to a cocktail immediately after we're done here. But before I do so, I must tell you a story. I was trying to find my way to this conference, and people kept telling me it's down there, and I got closer to a student party in the lobby, and I thought, my God, McGill has really pumped up its law conferences. It's great. So I'm a partner at Woods LLP. We're a litigation and insolvency boutique here in Montreal, and it's with great pleasure that we're associated with these lectures and that we invite you to a cocktail on the sixth floor, I believe. Thank you.
You're done?
You're off.
That was great, George. That was great. Very provocative.
I didn't get the